This week on Education Radio.
Charter schools are now an institution run by hustlers, grifters, greedy corporations.
So we have come to the point in this society where the dominant discourse is one of blaming individuals and putting the responsibility on individuals for what is the failure of the economic system and the failure of the government.
Public schools have also always been a site of contestation. It's always been a site that people have struggled over as we try to define not only what we want our next generation to become, but also what we want our society to evolve into. It's basically, in other words, the site of struggle for what the future could be.
If the right to an education follows the individual, not the municipality, not the city, then how is it that you can have a competition over who's going to get what resources? How can you have it where you're going to give money to these kids and not to those kids? Why do you have a race? Because a race inevitably has winners and losers. And how are you going to set up education to have winners and losers?
Welcome to Education Radio. I'm Danny O'Brien. Today we'll be discussing charter schools and the role they play in privatizing public education. All of us at Education Radio were interested in creating a show around the charter school movement. However, we weren't sure how to approach the issue. There was some debate on how best to capture the role that charter schools play in privatizing education. However, after a lot of discussion and debate, we decided that for our first charter school episode, we asked the broader question, why is it important to keep public education public? And what role do charter schools play in privatizing education? Like many people, I was initially intrigued by the concept of charter schools. I didn't know much about them, but from what I had heard in the news and from others, they sounded like a great public alternative to the rigid standardized tests and canned curriculum that was taking place in public schools. However, in 2008, I began teaching English to students with learning disabilities at an urban school and started looking at charter schools in a different light. The charter schools in the towns surrounding the city where I taught were touting themselves as open to all, but in reality, they catered to students who were from upper-class families. Students who did not live near the schools, which were about 20 miles outside of the city, needed to provide their own transportation or pay for a bus service. Furthermore, these schools didn't offer the same special education services that students like mine required. As I learned more about charter schools, it became clear that they were not the beacons of innovation they were said to be, but rather they were a tool used to privatize education. Today we'll be talking to teachers, parents, activists, and scholars who are all active in the fight to keep public education public. While their experiences and stories are different, they have all come to the understanding that current education reform policies undermine the goal of public education. While no one would argue that public education is where it needs to be, we unite on our belief that privatizing education is harmful and dangerous, not only to students, but to the ideals of democracy and society as a whole. We start our show by looking at some of the differences between public schools and charter schools. There is a widely held myth that charter schools are a type of public school. However, upon further examination, it becomes clear that while charter schools are privy to public funds, they are not bound by the same rules and regulations as public schools. First, we'll hear from Julie Kavanaugh, a special education teacher, activist, and filmmaker in Red Hook, Brooklyn, about her activism in the fight against charter schools. Julie, along with other members of the grassroots education movement, directed, wrote, and is featured in the documentary The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman. This film was a response to the myths and propaganda presented in Waiting for Superman, which depicted charter schools as the answer to so-called education failure and blamed unions and teachers for low test scores. As Julie will explain, these charter school myths are used to further the privatization movement and dismantle public education. Here she will explain some of the myths about charter schools presented in Waiting for Superman and discuss the realities that her and the other filmmakers worked to expose.
Waiting for Superman focused very, very heavily on the illusion that charter schools somehow provide an answer to some of the problems we face in public education. And in fact, the film very much centers around that idea in that it follows several children who, for various reasons, having been dissatisfied, and in a couple cases not necessarily dissatisfied with the public schools that they had access to, they decided to make a change and apply to a lottery for a charter school. I think what we expose in our film is several things. The first thing these are sort of myths within the larger myth. The first thing is that the movie and sort of the argument in general is that charter schools are public schools. And that's not true at all. Charter schools, in fact, are education corporations under state law. In New York, that's literally what they're called, and other states are very similar. They are their own independent boards of education or their own independent school district. And that leaves parents and the children who attend these schools in a situation where they have no one to turn to and have very difficult legal recourse in the event that something happens in these schools to their children, if they're dissatisfied with curriculum, if there's something that comes up with a disciplinary issue or behavior, or even if they, you know, have an idea or want to be somehow involved in the school. Charter schools really are not places or don't have the structure set up to sort of accommodate that. There's a parent in our film who talks about after she enrolled her children in a charter school, she realized it wasn't the place for an informed, involved parent like herself. Most charter schools do not allow parent-teacher associations. So that's one piece. You know, charter schools are education corporations and the impact that has on children and on families. In addition to the impact it has on children and families in that context, it's also troubling because while they receive public funds, they are in fact run by private companies and private individuals. And so in reality, what you're seeing is a transfer of public wealth out of the hands of the public, because these schools are paid with tax dollars just like our public schools are. But instead of remaining in the public coffers and benefiting society as a whole, this money is being transferred into the hands of education corporations, the charters themselves, the members of their boards, their founders, and the private companies that manage them. So the idea that charter schools are public schools is, you know, a very disingenuous label and certainly a misnomer that the public needs to understand the truth behind. I think one of the other big things, I mean, there's several things that we expose in the film about charter schools, but I think the other big myth sort of within the myth about charter schools being a silver bullet is that, you know, the tagline out there is that charters outperform public schools. And again, the research simply doesn't bear that out. And there's two factors here. One, the first being the easiest and most obvious way is that in fact, the data, according to test scores, does not show that that's true. The CREDA study, which has been the largest and most comprehensive study up to date that's been done comparing charter schools and public schools, shows that charter schools actually do the same or worse than public schools. The majority of them do not do better than public schools. And then the other issue that we expose in the film related to that is not only does the basic research or data not show that charter schools outperform public schools, but in smaller cases, like in New York City, for example, where this argument has played out, and if you just look at the basic data, it seems that particularly certain charters do consistently outperform public schools, KIPP, for example, or Harlem Success Academy, for example. What you find when you look into the data is a few things. One, they serve far fewer children who are English language learners. They serve far fewer children who receive special education services, and they serve far fewer children who fall below the poverty line. And that data also can be broken down into two ways, by reduced and free lunch. Most of the data combines them, but children who receive free lunch actually, you know, obviously are far more significant in terms of being below the poverty line than those who receive reduced lunch. So charter schools not only have a lower rate of children living in poverty, but they have an even much lower rate of children who receive free lunch. And all of these factors negatively impact standardized test scores, which is what this argument that charter schools outperform public schools is based on. The other component to that data that's really important to understand, and there's a brilliant graph of this in the film, is this. The idea of attrition. Attrition has to do with the number of children that leave a school throughout any given school year. And public schools certainly have attrition too. I mean, kids move, you know, families move to different neighborhoods, different states. But what you see in charter schools is a disproportionate number of children who leave a charter school as compared to a public school. And moreover, even in cases where you might see similar attrition between a neighborhood public school and a nearby charter school, the charter school has a much lower incidence of replacing the children who leave, particularly after first grade. And so in the film, this chart shows that if you just look at a charter school's achievement numbers from, let's say, third through eighth grade, and we use four charter schools in the film, but you can do that. We've done it with many. It's consistent throughout. So if you look at their test score numbers from third through eighth grade, what you'll see is a line that consistently rises so that it seems like they keep showing increased achievement. The students that attend their schools keep showing increased achievement over time. But when you overlay that same graph with their attrition numbers, there's a mirror pattern. So as the achievement numbers go up, the number of students attending their school goes down. And they're almost exact mirrors of each other. So the reality is, the truth is, as they push children out, as they counsel children out, as they don't replace the children who, for whatever reason, didn't succeed in their school or posed a difficulty in their school, as they get rid of those quote-unquote trouble children, their scores go up. And of course, the public schools who do not have the option to counsel children out or be selective in who they serve are serving all children, and that, of course, impacts test scores. So these are some of the things that we discussed in the film about charter schools. There are certainly more, but I would say those are the two big myths that are out there that we debunk pretty strongly.
This is Education Radio, and we've been listening to teacher, activist, and member of the grassroots education movement, Julie Kavanaugh, discussing the myths about charter schools. Julie, alongside other grassroots education movement members, released The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman in 2011 as a response to the lies and propaganda presented in the 2010 film Waiting for Superman. As Julie makes clear, charter schools are public in name only. They receive public funds but are not bound by the same rules and regulations as traditional public schools. Charter schools are severely underserving students with disabilities, English language learners, and low-income students, and are able to push and counsel out students who they deem as troubled children. In this next section, Julie will explain some of the dangers in privatizing public schools and the ways in which the push towards charter schools moves us away from the promise of public education.
The danger becomes, as we move more and more towards charter, whether you're a small boutique school, whether you have, you know, two charters in an area or 10, as we move more and more towards charter, because this idea has been hijacked, we move further and further away from the idea and from the promise of what public education was supposed to be and is supposed to be. You know, I think that's something that's really dangerous. We're not supposed to have to fill out an application to access a public school. The idea that children should have to enter a lottery to get a good education or an education at all is not something that holds true to the ideal or the ideas of what public education was supposed to be. And I think you open up the possibility that somehow education doesn't become something that is central in a community and there to sort of bring a society together and train in some ways our children to be members, productive members of the society, when you start creating a system that is fragmented and separated. And, you know, in fact, what we do know about charters is that they actually increase segregation and they decrease educational access for some children, even though they do the exact opposite for others. And so instead of focusing our attention and our money and our efforts on creating a more fragmented system than we already have, a more segregated system than we already have, we think that we should be focused on how to create a unified public school system that is able to serve all children collectively and doesn't open up the possibility for private interest to exploit the public dollar for their own benefit.
For me, one of the most inspiring aspects of The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman was the parent involvement and activism featured in the film. One of those parents, Lisa Donlin, also helped to make the film. Lisa serves as the president of New York's District 1 Community Education Council and has been active in the fight against charter school co-location in the Lower East Side. In this clip from The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, Lisa speaks about the role that money plays in the privatization of public education.
We managed to really take the public out of public education, which has allowed the reformers to then take the education out of public education and replace it with this accountability game based on high-stakes testing and all kinds of phony measures that really don't measure the teaching and learning that real kids in real schools in real communities require. It's money versus democracy. We have incredibly powerful moneyed forces that are trying to privatize education to reduce public costs, because most of them are paying for private schools for their own children and they're not invested in the industry of public education. It's not about education, but it's about containing the cost. It's about employing less experienced and therefore less expensive, cheaper teaching force. It's a teaching force that you can then control, and you can control the cost. We need all of the teaching force with the backing of a strong union to join parents, single educators, people that are starting to figure out, some of our elected leaders, that this is not really a reform of education. This is another game. If we want to improve teaching and learning in our schools, we need to bring the unions and the communities together and come back to more local decision-making about what is best for kids and communities.
Julie, Lisa, and the other members of the grassroots education movement make clear the ways in which charter schools and public schools differ. Charter schools receive public funds but can kick students out, can deny special education services, and are exempt from many of the rules and regulations required of public schools. Often, proponents of corporate education reform stress the importance of choice in a high-quality education system. I often wonder how the concept of choice in education became synonymous with quality in education. To better understand this shift, I spoke with activist, author, and professor of education studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago, Pauline Lipman. Pauline's most recent book, The New Political Economy of Urban Education, Neoliberalism, Race, and the Right to the City, explores the way that education reform and the privatization of education is related to urban restructuring, and explains how education reform continues to be rooted in racist ideas that lead to the further oppression of people of color. Here Pauline answers some of my questions about how the discourse of blame, pathology, and choice are used to manufacture consent for the privatization of public education and the public sphere in general.
High-stakes accountability discourse is located inside a larger neoliberal discourse of blame and pathologizing, in which the failures of the public sphere, whether it's public housing, public health care, or the failure of the economy, for that matter, is blamed on the people rather than blamed on the government for its policies and blamed on the corporate financial sector for disinvestment. So we have this huge discourse of blame and pathology. Public housing is bad because we have too many poor people concentrated in one place there, and these pathologies are highly racialized. The subtext is all about African Americans in the case of public housing. So I think in the case of schools, we have the same kind of thing in which there is a failure, and that failure is then blamed on teachers, and it's blamed on students, it's blamed on their parents who aren't working with kids on their homework, getting them ready for school, and so forth. And that is a deeply racialized pathology. So that racialized pathologizing discourse has resonance in the United States, in a society that is permeated by white supremacist ideologies and always has been. And I think that it's a very colonial discourse. It's a sense in which schools and teachers and parents could not solve their problems if they had the support and the resources and the political will, but instead that it's those experts, those people with power within the government, who must make mandates and correct people in urban communities in particular and in schools. And so now we see the evolution of this blaming discourse in films like Waiting for Superman, where it's very clear that teacher unions are the problem. Teacher unions protect bad teachers, and since bad teachers are the problem, then we see that clearly a scheme that privatizes schools and that takes teacher unions out of the equation is part of the solution in that framing and in that discourse. And so I think that's where we are today. And actually, when we look at this whole project of charter schools and choice, when I attend the annual New Schools Expo, which is a sort of expo of charter schools in Chicago, and they have workshops, over and over, what we hear is that good parents are parents who spend their time searching for a school and make sure that their kids get to that charter school, even if the charter school is across town, even if getting into a charter school means filling out 10, 12, 15, 20 applications, going to the public library to do it on their computer because they're all online and you don't have a computer at home. So that's a caring parent. A parent who doesn't do that is not a caring parent. So we have come to the point in this society where the dominant discourse is one of blaming individuals and putting the responsibility on individuals for what is the failure of the economic system and the failure of the government.
You talked a little bit about the discourse of blame that you hear. Can you talk a little bit about the discourse of choice?
Yes. So again, I think the discourse of choice, the reason it has resonance is that it fits into, it speaks to the actual lack of real educational equity and real education opportunities historically for African American and Latino students and for working class students. So we should be honest that affluent parents, particularly white parents, have always had choice. For example, they've chosen to move into neighborhoods, move out of cities into affluent suburbs, and so on, that have good school systems. So their affluence has given them a choice. And if the public school system didn't work, they could send their kids to private schools. As I said, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, has made a choice. He has the options to make any kind of choice he wants, and he chose to send his children to the University of Chicago Lab School. So in that sense, this discourse of choice resonates with folks who see that some people have choice and they don't have choice. Their only option has been historically a neighborhood school which may be disinvested, which lacks many of the actually necessary learning materials, up-to-date science labs, computers, technology, a full set of classroom books so that students can actually take books home and do homework, arts, music, all those kinds of things. So in that context, the discourse of choice actually resonates with people, because if you could move your child out of that school into a school that's supposedly better or that it's being presented as better, then you actually see that as being able to exercise some kind of agency. And this is in a context in which no matter how much you've worked inside the school, talked to the principal, talked to teachers, you felt that issues of racism, issues of inequality have not been addressed. You go to the school board, you demand new windows in your school because the air is rushing in the middle of winter and they don't do anything about it, the boiler is broken, et cetera, et cetera. This happens at every single school board meeting. And so clearly, if you're given a choice, quote-unquote choice, to go somewhere better, you're going to take it. So there is a good sense in the choice, which is rooted in these failures historically. And we have to see that as part of the equation that we're operating in. So unfortunately, the actual program of choice is not actually a solution, because, first of all, the charter schools that are one of the choice options, we're beginning to see from the research, A, on average, they're not doing any better than public schools nationally. And that's also true in Chicago. And B, as we've seen from the recent study that was done in Michigan on the KIPP charter schools achieve their so-called stellar results, in fact, by pushing kids out who are going to tarnish their test scores. And certainly in Chicago, many of the charter schools work in such a way that kids get pushed out for behavior. Kids who are not doing well academically get pushed out. And we have much anecdotal evidence about this. Secondly, and probably in the big picture, what is most detrimental about this discourse of choice and how it's been sold to people is that it has turned people into individual consumers. So people start to think about choice as their individual choice. So every parent is now a shopper in the supermarket of schools in Chicago, trying to get into a magnet school, trying to get into a charter school. I have a friend who filled out 60 applications for her kindergartner for public schools and charter schools in Chicago in an attempt to make a choice. So I think that in context in which parents have historically had few options and in which their neighborhood schools are disinvested neighborhood schools, which is not their fault and is not the fault of the teachers, in fact, that choice presents itself as a good option. And then, of course, it's situated in a larger discourse in which we are all being encouraged to think of democracy as a marketplace, as a big supermarket. So everything, every way in which we exercise some kind of agency, some kind of ability to affect things, is by individually going out and buying something that will supposedly solve the problem, whether it's public housing being pushed into the marketplace of housing, whether it's school choice and vouchers in terms of education, or whether it's the privatization of all kinds of other things, from water to all kinds of public services. So I think there's a larger discourse, but I think that we have to see where it's situated, which is why it is not enough to simply say choice is not working, which it's not. We also have to say, so what is the alternative? How do we transform public school in ways in which there is a high-quality school in every single neighborhood so that people don't have to, and people in neighborhoods can work together to improve that school and to make demands on that school rather than everyone becoming an individual and competing with his or her neighbor over whose child is going to get into whatever school.
We've been talking to Pauline Lippman, professor and activist, who has explained how discourses of blame, pathology, and choice have been used to garner support for charter schools and further privatize public education. What most impressed me about Pauline's book was the final chapter about resistance. In this next section, I speak with Pauline about the right to education and ask her advice on how one can push back against corporate education reform. In the new political economy, you talk about the right to the city and the right to education. For people listening who want to work against what they see going on, what would you say to them, or what advice would you give?
Well, in that book, one of the things that I talk about, because I do talk about the intersection between education policy and other urban policies, housing policy, economic development policy, you know, tax policy, that I think the first thing is that we need to recognize that the struggle for really equitable and quality and transformative education has to be linked to these other issues in the city. When so few resources are going into a particular African-American community and then so few resources are going into the school and then people are being foreclosed in that neighborhood or public housing has been destroyed and people have been pushed into the public housing market and it's created tremendous destabilization, then all those issues are linked with the school issue. So one thing is that I think we have to see that, as Jean Anion said, what counts as education policy is not only education. It's housing policy. It's the city's economic development policy. It's their taxing policy. So that's one thing. So I think that people working around education need to make connections with people who are working around those things in other areas. But the second thing is that when Henri Lefebvre talked about the right to the city, he talked about it as a cry and a demand. And I think what he was saying there was that it was a demand in the sense that it was a demand for everyone to have access to the city. So that's really the question of everyone having access to high-quality education, for example, or having access to a living wage job, or having access to affordable and decent housing, or having access to health care. But the cry in Lefebvre's framework is equally important. This is a cry for something different. It's not just a cry. It's not just that we want access to equitable public education. We actually want to transform public education. And so Lefebvre talks about making the city into the city we want it to be, making education into, he doesn't talk about education, but I would talk about education, is making the schools into the schools that we want them to be. So I think that the progress of the sort of national resistance to neoliberal education policies, to high-stakes testing, to privatization, to attacks on unions and so forth, has been a process of resistance. Don't close our school, stop the high-stakes testing, and so forth. But I think that we are beginning to see a move to a new place, which is the place where we really need to go, which is not simply opposing their policies, because after all, their discourse has been, well, do you just want to go back to the failed policies of the past? But instead, moving beyond opposition to putting forward a positive agenda for what we actually want, for how we could both have access and actually transform public schools. And I think that that is a critical piece of what we need to do in our teacher unions, in the community struggles, and the teacher struggles around education.
This is Education Radio. Today we've been examining the privatization of public schools and how the charter school movement works to dismantle public education. Charter schools are often viewed as the solution to the high-stakes testing and accountability that is seen in public education. However, they are actually a part of the same system of reform that is pushing for increased teacher surveillance, canned curriculum, and high-stakes testing. Furthermore, while the corporate education reform movement, and charter schools in particular, use a discourse of social justice and racial equality, the reality is education reform and charter schools are failing minority students and further segregating schools and communities. Next, we will hear from education activist, actor, and teacher Brian Jones. Brian recently gave a speech entitled Still Separate, Still Unequal: Racism, Class, and the Attack on Public Education, in which he examines the intersections between racism, classism, and the corporate education reform movement. Brian makes clear how education reformers use the language of social justice to push an agenda that hurts those it claims to help.
Kids today live in profoundly segregated worlds. Today, great majorities of students of all races, actually, according to a study by the UCLA's Civil Rights Project, now attend overwhelmingly segregated schools. Actually, white students in some ways are the most segregated racially. And it was Jonathan Kozol, I believe, who pointed out that if you want to find the most segregated school in any urban district, you simply must seek out the school that's named after one of the leading lights of desegregation. Your Thurgood Marshalls, your Rosa Parks Elementaries, your Martin Luther King Academies are invariably in Philadelphia, in Boston, in New York, in Los Angeles, are invariably the most segregated schools that you will find. And so the reformers come along, and they promise that by releasing teacher data reports, which we're now going to have, by raising the stakes of high-stakes standardized tests, by privatization, by increasing charter schools, and importantly, by breaking the power of teacher unions, that all of these things, greater accountability, all of these things are going to promote racial justice. And I would argue that, in effect, starting with No Child Left Behind, what they've done is raise the banner and the call for excellence and forget about or put to the side the question of equity. That is, the question and the arguments that were made for so many years about a segregated system of schooling were about resources, not just about who got to sit next to what child, but importantly, in such a deeply racist society where wealth follows skin color so profoundly and so persistently, black parents have always known one of the surest and quickest ways to make sure that your child is not isolated, to make sure that your child is not cheated out of a decent education, is to get your child into a school where there are children of other races, and especially where there are white children. And in the absence of that, we have neither equity nor excellence. No Child Left Behind demands that by 2014, we have 100% proficiency reading of absolutely every single soul. Jumping over any question of equity, jumping over any question of resources or equality of opportunity, we're actually just demanding excellence, and thereby we're going to have it. Race to the top. Obama came to power overwhelmingly. Find me a teacher who didn't vote for Obama. Teachers were excited because Obama was saying all of the right things. No Child Left Behind is broken. No Child Left Behind is wrong. We're teaching to the test. We didn't get the input from teachers. That was the problem, you see. And then he turns around and gives us Race to the Top. This is the first African-American president. He basically doubles down on No Child Left Behind. It's worse than No Child Left Behind. Because No Child Left Behind says that the child's future is determined by the test scores. Race to the Top says the child's future is determined by this bubble sheet, and so is the teacher's future determined by the bubble sheet, and so is the principal's future determined by the bubble sheet, and so is the school's future determined by the bubble sheet. It's now everybody's future is determined by the bubble sheet. Shockingly, people are cheating on the bubble sheet. Shocking. The NAACP released a report, and they were going to have a big press conference about it. Somebody in the Obama administration talked to them, apparently, because they quietly released it. This was about a year and a half ago. I could be wrong. It was about a year and a half ago, I believe. And the report basically made a very straightforward case and said, look, this is the NAACP, assumingly, you know, supporters of Obama. They said, if the right to an education follows the individual, not the municipality, not the city, then how is it that you can have a competition over who's going to get what resources? How can you have it where you're going to give money to these kids and not to those kids? Why do you have a race? Because a race inevitably has winners and losers. And how are you going to set up education to have winners and losers? And they said that charter schools, that the race to the competitive grant system, that all of these things that were being set up, they cited, were already leading to greater racial stratification. And this is what I want to talk about, is that the results of the thing that they brought up, racial justice in the schools, the results of what they're doing are actually worse. Where have they gotten away with the most? New Orleans. What is the and by the way, remember what Arne Duncan said about New Orleans? That the best thing that happened to the schools in New Orleans was Hurricane Katrina. Look what happened to the schools of New Orleans. Overwhelmingly charterized. They destroyed the teachers' union, and now they have a highly stratified system of education where it's very difficult. The poorest students are concentrated in the few remaining public schools, which are very run down, underfunded, and having a very difficult time. And then as you move up the system into the system of selective and charterized schools, then the population gets wealthier and whiter. And that's now the school system of New Orleans, the privatized non-union school system of New Orleans.
We've just heard from activist, educator, and filmmaker Brian Jones. Brian makes clear how the privatization of public education, including charter schools, works to reproduce racial and economic inequality. As Brian explains, education reform has created schools that are more separate and more unequal, and charter schools are no exception. Despite what we are often told by the media, research continues to show that charter schools are more racially segregated than their public school counterparts. Next, we will hear from University of Chicago, Illinois professor William Watkins. Watkins is the editor of the recently published book, The Assault on Public Education, which examines the devastating impacts of corporate-driven education reform. Education Radio producers Barbara Mataloni, Tim Scott, and myself interviewed Watkins and spoke with him about the racism behind the education reform movement, the ways in which corporate education reformers appropriate the language of social justice, and how the education reform movement could lead to the dismantling of universal public education.
Can you explain a little bit about how the neoliberal agenda is also a racist agenda? And you write to that in your book.
Racism persists. The notion of a post-racial society is fiction. The neoliberals are driven, first and foremost, by money. They trample on everyone's rights. But they inherited a racial legacy. They inherited racist institutions. They inherited a racialized society, which they have done little to alter. So even as they usurp, they being the neoliberals, even as they usurp power and wealth unto themselves, they still maintain the existing racial relationships, which they find convenient. Why are they convenient? Because they're divisive. They have served the interests of divide and conquer for hundreds of years, and racism continues to serve the hegemonic order. So why tamper with it? So racism is probably the only institution that remains untouched in the new social order.
In the first chapter that you wrote, you have a section called The Black Middle Class, a Status Report. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's very clear what we used to call the Negro question. The Negro question has always been central to American political life and American social life, not just to the lives of African Americans, but much of our history has to do with the situating of African Americans, whether it's through slavery, sharecropping, or second class citizenship, second class status. And so I wanted to take note of the emergent black middle class that's always been with us, as I point out in the piece, going back to the slave aristocracy, going back to those blacks that gained favor. We've always had a small black middle class. However, at this point, that black middle class has become institutionalized and needs to be understood differently in this social order. Whereas now we have a black president, we have black CEOs, we have black millionaires and billionaires. So we need to understand the changing racial dynamics of the country, although racism has not changed. So I try to take some time to look at the embeddedment of the black middle class, which I think is now a permanent fixture in American class society.
What are your thoughts on how neoliberal education reformers use the discourse or the rhetoric around social justice, and specifically the term achievement gap, as though neoliberal policies in education is the common sense way to address inequality?
Yeah, they have attempted to appropriate notions of common sense. More importantly, they have appropriated populist language, as right-wing conservative forces have been known to do throughout the modern period. Even the names that are given to some of their programs, No Child Left Behind. You don't get more populist sounding than No Child Left Behind. The word accountability has populist overtones. They have appropriated populist language. They've appropriated democratic language, as you pointed out, common sense language, to carry out the most diabolical of schemes. And so this is nothing new. We're getting one kind of rhetoric and another kind of action. And we should always be concerned more with the action than the rhetoric.
In the introduction of The Assault on Public Education, you explain that the restructuring of education will lead to the dismantling of universal public education and will de-school a significant number of black, brown, and poor people. Can you speak to this a bit?
Public education has always been tied to labor economics, and especially to the labor market. I mean, schools don't exist in a vacuum. They don't exist in a cocoon. Schools are always connected to the needs of the labor market as viewed by those in power. So as industrialization emerged, schools were constructed to meet the challenges of industrialization. So we had schools preparing people for the factories. Here in Chicago, we have schools located right near the steel mills that look exactly like the steel mills of old. And the students in some of those schools were prepared to go from school a few blocks away to the steel mill. Easy transition. So schools have always been a function of the labor market and have been inextricably connected to the labor market. Well, what is the new labor market looking like? The new labor market is a technocratic society. The new labor market doesn't require armies of industrial toilers working in huge factories like Henry Ford once had, or Andrew Carnegie's steel mills, which employed 100,000 people per shift. Now we're having satellite labor. We're having scattered labor. We're having a different kind of labor, which requires a different kind of education. And it also means that we're going to have large numbers of people moving to the ranks of the unskilled, the de-skilled, and the unemployed. That's already the case. No one will quarrel with that. Our country already has probably 40, some estimate even 50 million people unemployed. Even Obama will tell you 25 or 30. So you can just about double that figure. And many of those people will not be employed again because those jobs are gone. the jobs are gone either to another part of the world or have given way to digitization. We're in a whole new ball game. We're in both unanticipated, unforeseen, and misunderstood territory. We're moving, if ever there was the possibility of the obsolescence of human labor, we're on the precipice of that at this point.
Just before, you used the word diabolical to describe what's been happening in education through these so-called ed reforms. Can you expound and get into some detail about what exactly has been diabolical about it and what actions you see and what policies have been so damaging?
Sure. Let me highlight a couple. First, probably without question, the most significant has been No Child Left Behind, the act that was signed into law in 2000 by George Bush. The provisions of No Child Left Behind, for all practical purposes, restructure public education as we know it. The act is punitive, calls for mandatory standardized testing. It calls for benchmarks for schools, and schools that do not meet their benchmarks for 3 contiguous years can be placed in some kind of receivership or can in fact be closed. And here in Chicago and around the country, we are now witnessing the wholesale closings of schools. Here in Chicago, the current mayor, Emanuel, and his superintendent, Brizard, have proposed closing nearly 100 schools over the next 3 years. And we are having a massive protest and pushback by parents and by the community against these school closings. So we're not just talking about something that may happen, or we're not just talking about a hypothetical situation. Public education is being transformed and shut down right in front of our very faces.
How do you see charter schools playing into this?
Charter schools began with the legitimate sentiment of parents and well-meaning people who wanted to experiment with new models of education. And the charter school seemed like a creative opportunity for this. That was very short-lived. Charter schools are now an institution run by hustlers, grifters, greedy corporations. Charter schools are now the objects of profiteering because here in Chicago, the charter schools are owned by large corporations who, once they are granted their charter, they receive public funds. They receive the same capital expenditures that the public schools receive. And they are proving to be quite profitable, and they are spreading. So we should look at charter schools, as they have evolved, as primarily a scam, and perhaps one of the great scams of our time.
We've just heard from University of Chicago, Illinois professor William Watkins. Watkins' analysis paints a dismal but honest portrait about the ways in which education reform policies, including charter schools, high-stakes testing, and other so-called accountability measures, are working to undermine the goals of public education. As Watkins explained, the devastating impacts of education reform are not mere threats, but are taking hold in cities and towns across the country. Perhaps no city better understands the brutality of education reform than Watkins' home city of Chicago. For the last 10 years, Chicago has served as a test lab for the corporate education reform movement. Chicago's former CEO of Education, Arnie Duncan, now serves as the United States Secretary of Education and is one of the masterminds behind Obama's race to the top. In Chicago, his policies have led to the closing and privatization of many schools. Recently, despite outcry from parents, teachers, and the Chicago's teacher union, the current mayor has pushed forward with the decision to close or phase out 7 of Chicago's public schools. Additionally, 10 other schools have been designated as turnaround schools, meaning most likely the entire staff will be replaced and they will be converted into charter schools. Karen Lewis, current president of the Chicago Teachers Union and nationally board certified teacher, has been deeply involved in the fight for public education in Chicago for years. Education Radio's Deborah Keisch-Polin spoke with Karen about some of the issues she sees with charters based on her work in Chicago.
The charter school movement actually grew out of the voucher movement and the so-called school choice movement. Unfortunately, what we've seen is that it's not really choice. It's very, 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 very false choice. There are a couple of real issues. One, what we see in charter schools is an intense heightening of resegregation. So we see charter schools that are almost entirely black or entirely Mestizo, which has a different set of issues associated with it. We see them with a significantly lower special ed population, and as a matter of fact, have accepted people, then find out, oh, these kids are special, and then counsel them out, which we have a real problem with. They are also very weak on their emergent bilingual population. And in some charter schools, which actually cater to the Latino population, refuse to do any bilingual work. But the biggest problem with charter schools, quite frankly, is the lack of accountability. And especially on a fiscal level, which everybody else has to be on. And as a matter of fact, they didn't report test scores on charter schools until quite recently, when they were kind of forced to defend themselves. So what we see are some charters that have reasonable test scores. But what's very interesting about them is that they also push children out or make it difficult for their parents to be a part of the process. And again, there's no parent governance with charter schools. I mean, there's just a lot of things that on paper look good, but when you start peeling away the layers, you start seeing a very different picture. So the issue is, though, how do we appropriately educate a variety of children with a variety of issues? And what are the concerns that parents have that send them to charters? And I think those are questions that have been unanswered for many, many years. So what created this environment, you know? So those are the kinds of things that need to have a real discussion about. But for the district, what is concerning to me is that the people who are in charge of running the district spend so much time denigrating it and then saying, well, we can't handle it. We don't know how to educate these kids, so we're going to let somebody else do it. I mean, it's like you can't have it both ways. Either you make the commitment to educate everyone or you abrogate the responsibility. Then you need to move on as opposed to giving the schools away. The real problems around charter schools is that when people don't have a voice and when public trust is privatized, then we have all kinds of other issues that come along with that. So that is what I would say is the broad discussion. And then in addition, when you look at them, they either don't do that much better or in some cases do worse.
An argument that I often hear from people who support charters is, you know, two pieces of the big ones. One is, well, you know, why does it matter? You know, we're doing something over here. There's still public education. We're not taking away from the public education system. There's sort of that misunderstanding. And then also, we want to do something innovative that isn't possible in the public school, which I think you were sort of speaking to a little bit.
Sure. I think the problem is that the innovation argument is false. There have been no innovations in curriculum. There have been no innovations in instructional delivery. The only innovations in charter schools have been the labor management issues. That's where the innovation has occurred. There have been no other innovations. That is why the whole charter school piece as being, oh, we need flexibility to do this, that, and the other, is a false discussion and argument. So that's where we have their major issue. And even their supporters admit this. Andrew Broy, who's the Illinois Charter School Network president or executive director, whatever his job title is, said that in a meeting and admitted that the only innovation they've had is in the labor management relations. So this is what I know from other charter schools who are looking to unionize. They want to pay men more than they pay women. This has been a problem. They want to pay people that teach the quote-unquote more difficult subjects differently than what they pay other people. So they set up this inequity within their ranks. So they set up the inequity within the ranks of students. All of this stuff comes full circle. So that is one of the issues that just really makes things interesting, because the whole idea of innovation is extremely important. Who would disagree with innovation? The only problem is they don't have any.
That was the Chicago Teacher Union President and nationally board-certified teacher, Karen Lewis, speaking about the troubling impacts of charter schools, both in Chicago and across the country. Karen makes clear the need for parents, teachers, students, and activists to work together and speak out against the corporate-driven education reform. I think it's important that we don't see the situation in Chicago as unique or rare, but rather see it as a warning as to what will happen in cities and towns across the country if we do not fight back against these education reform policies. We started the show by asking why we should keep public education public. We will close the show by listening to Dr. Kevin Kumashero's answer to this question. Kevin is currently a professor of Asian American Studies and Education at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's also the president-elect of the National Association of Multicultural Education. Education Radio producer Tim Scott spoke with Kevin, and his answer provides hope for those of us who believe that public education can be used as a tool of resistance and liberation.
Now, Kevin, you had referenced how public education has always served the function of sorting students and reproducing oppression and inequality. So for people who are interested in liberation and justice, why should we attach ourselves to public education? If it's always been a problem and always been oppressive, then what's the alternative?
Yeah, I was having this conversation recently because you could argue that a parallel conversation that's happening is around prison abolition. We have this public institution, prisons, well, more and more now a private institution, but we have this institution that people are arguing should be abolished, that we should imagine what societies look like without prisons, right? And the question was posed, well, should we be making a similar kind of argument about public education? And in fact, that's what a lot of people argue, right? This has been a part of kind of the Republican platform, for example, for decades, right? Get rid of the U.S. Department of Education, privatize public education. This is a huge drain on our economy. It's the largest enterprise that looks kind of socialist to some people, right? Okay, so a lot of people are arguing that. And I guess what I would say is that although schools have always played and still do play a sorting function in society, it's also the case that schools have also always been a site of contestation. It's always been a site that people have struggled over as we try to define not only what we want our next generation to become, but also what we want our society to evolve into. It's basically, in other words, the site of struggle for what the future could be. And I think that that's a site worth continuing to struggle over. And I think rather than saying, this is a institution that has all these problems, let's give up on it, I would say, no, this is a reason why we should invest even more of our resources and our time and our intellectual energy and our creativity into, because it has the potential, I believe really strongly, in making our society more democratic and more just and more inclusive than it is today.
We've just heard from professor and activist Kevin Kumashero explaining the importance and potential for public education. As we conclude this edition of Education Radio, I think it is important to consider Kevin's message that public education can serve to make our society more democratic and more just. If we consider the damage that will be done if charter schools continue to replace public schools, it becomes clear that we must take action. I urge those of you listening to find a way to get involved in this fight and play a role in rebuilding public education so that all of society benefits. If teachers, parents, students, and other activists join in solidarity, we can fight against the assault on public education and work toward building a just society that serves the needs of all people. Education Radio is produced by the Education Radio Collective. Check out our blog at education-radio.blogspot.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter.